December 2nd, 1919, Toronto, Ontario. Ambrose Small, a wealthy 56-year-old theater tycoon, has just completed a deal to sell off his holdings for $1.7 million. After having a meeting with his lawyer at his office at the Grand Opera House, Small vanishes without a trace. Over the years, suspicion would be directed toward Small's wife and his personal secretary, who fled the country after stealing some of Small's bonds. But there is no evidence to implicate anybody. The case is officially closed in 1960, and there are reported sightings of Small's ghost haunting one of his former theaters, but his ultimate fate remains unknown. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello everyone, and welcome to a very special milestone. Today we'll be presenting the 100th episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and yes, even I cannot believe that we have made it to 100 episodes. Our podcast has been around for over 2 years now, but it did not hit me until about a month ago when I looked at the numbers on our episodes and minisodes and realized, wow, they almost equal 100. So after producing 68 full-length episodes and 32 minisodes, we have now officially reached that magic number. That voice you heard narrating our introduction is one of our listeners, Heather Jones. As you probably know, The Trail Went Cold has a monthly contest in which listeners can win the chance to narrate the opening on one of our episodes. But to commemorate this milestone, I thought I'd do something special. Instead of selecting one winner for this particular contest, I picked five. Heather Jones, Laura Fulks, Andrea Canfield, Abby Martin, and Casey Brandt. You just heard Heather's voice, and throughout the course of this episode, the other four winners will make voice cameos and narrate passages of the story. Anyway, for our 100th episode, I decided to pick an unsolved cold case which took place nearly 100 years ago, and it also happens to be one of the biggest mysteries in the history of Canada, the 1919 disappearance of Ambrose Small. It seemed like an appropriate choice, because The Trail Went Cold is a Canadian-produced podcast. This story also happened to take place in Toronto, and well, I've got a special announcement about a special podcasting event which is going to be taking place in Toronto in July, so stay tuned until the end of the episode to learn the full details. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. And just in time for our 100th episode, The Trail Went Cold is finally on Patreon. So if you would like to support the show, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold, and for as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards from our podcast, which may include stickers and thank you cards from yours truly, early access to episodes, and bonus content. I'm going to be providing a shout-out for some of our listeners who have already signed up for Patreon near the end of this episode. So with all that out of the way, here is Laura Fulks to start off our examination into the unsolved disappearance of Ambrose Small.
Our story begins in Toronto in 1919. Our central figure is 56-year-old Ambrose Small, who has become Canada's most prominent theater tycoon. Originally born in the town of Bradford, Ontario in 1863, Ambrose's family soon moved to Toronto, and at the age of 13, Ambrose started working for his father, Daniel Small, at the city's Grand Hotel. Daniel eventually helped his son get a job at the adjacent Grand Opera House, which was considered to be Toronto's premier concert hall. Over the next few years, Ambrose slowly worked his way up the ladder, but left the job after getting into a disagreement with the manager. After accepting a position at the nearby Toronto Opera House, Ambrose started to achieve success on his own and eventually became the manager of the theater. By the end of the 19th century, he had established himself as one of the top theatrical managers in Ontario.
Small purchased numerous theaters throughout the province, not just in Toronto, but in a number of different cities. His personal favorite establishment was reported to be the Grand Theatre in London, Ontario, which had been destroyed in a fire until Small had it rebuilt and reopened in September of 1901. Shortly thereafter, Ambrose got married for the first time to Teresa Corman, who happened to be the heiress of the Corman Brewing Company. In 1888, Ambrose's mother died, and his father eventually got remarried to Josephine Corman, who happened to be Teresa's sister. So yes, Ambrose technically married his own step-aunt, but there was a reason for this. Since Josephine had recently passed away, Teresa wound up inheriting her father's entire fortune from the Corman Brewing Company. With this newfound wealth, Ambrose now had the money to finally realize his dream of purchasing the Grand Opera House, firmly establishing himself as the most powerful theater tycoon in the country. In spite of their marriage, Ambrose and Teresa were pretty much polar opposites in every way. Teresa was known for being a very charitable, generous person, and a devout Catholic, while Ambrose hated Catholics and poor people, and scoffed at the entire idea of giving away money to charity. His two biggest vices were gambling and women, as he frequently wagered large amounts of money on horse races, some of which were fixed, and he constantly cheated on his wife. By the time 1919 rolled around, there was a substantial decline in the theatrical touring business, which probably had a lot to do with the rising popularity of motion pictures. So Ambrose and Teresa decided to sell all their theaters to a Montreal-based firm called TransCanada Theaters Limited. On December 1st, the deal was officially completed. The Smalls would immediately receive a check for $1 million, along with an additional $750,000, to be paid to them in annual installments over the next several years. The following morning, Teresa went to the Dominion Bank to deposit the $1 million check into their joint bank account, while Ambrose went on a spending spree purchasing gifts for his wife. He told Teresa he would meet her at their home for a celebratory dinner at 6 p.m. Later that afternoon, Ambrose had a meeting with his lawyer, E.W. Flock, at his office at the Grand Opera House. According to Flock, the sale of his holdings had put Small in a very cheery mood. They chatted for a few minutes and parted ways at 5:30 p.m., and this would turn out to be the last time Ambrose Small was confirmed to be alive. He never showed up to meet his wife for dinner, but it would be weeks before he was officially reported missing. You see, Teresa was well aware of her husband's womanizing and gambling habits, and it was not uncommon for him to disappear for days at a time in order to indulge in his vices. She initially figured that Ambrose must have gone off to celebrate their recent financial windfall. Since this probably meant Ambrose was with another woman somewhere, Teresa hesitated to contact the police, fearing that the whole thing could cause a potential scandal. In fact, the person who ultimately reported Small missing to the police was Thomas Flynn, the Ontario Racing Commissioner, who often provided him with tips on horse races, and grew concerned because Small had not yet contacted him to place any bets after making his $1 million sale. After contacting the police, Flynn then got in touch with the newspapers, who published their first story about Small's disappearance on January 3, 1920, a full month after he went missing. After this, the search for Small would become the largest manhunt in Canadian history up until that point. With his distinctive walrus mustache, Small was a very recognizable figure, and sightings of him started pouring in from all over the world. There is some debate about whether there were any confirmed sightings of Small after E.W. Flock left the Grand Opera House on December 2nd. A newsstand operator named Ralph Savine would claim that Small purchased a copy of the New York Times from him on the night he disappeared. The newsstand was located just outside the Opera House, and it was pretty much a nightly ritual for Small to purchase the New York Times from Savine after leaving the theater. On this particular night, no copies of the Times had arrived yet, because the train responsible for delivering them was delayed by a snowstorm. According to Savine, Small grumbled about this before he walked away and vanished. However, investigators did not buy Savine's story, and suspected that he made it up in order to garner some attention from all the press coverage Small's disappearance was receiving. If true, then no one could be certain if Small actually left the theater before he went missing. For this reason, there were a lot of wild rumors that Small may have been killed in the Grand Opera House and his remains concealed inside. The theater would be thoroughly searched on multiple occasions over the course of the next few decades, but nothing was ever found. A stagehand reported a strong odor coming out of the chimney on the evening of December 3rd, the night after Small disappeared, so investigators looked into the possibility that his body may have been incinerated inside the theater's large furnace. Nothing was ever found in the furnace, but it's worth mentioning that since Small wasn't reported missing for weeks, the furnace would have been cleaned before it was searched. There were no signs of violence inside Small's office, but the authorities discovered that there was a private secret room attached to it containing a bar, a bed, and a painting of a nude woman. It was rumored that Small used the room as a private meeting place to settle his gambling debts, but really, its primary purpose was for sexual liaisons, as Small often brought the actresses and chorus girls who performed in the opera house's shows back there. However, a search of the room failed to turn up any clues. Given Ambrose's notorious reputation for womanizing, there was much speculation that his wife might have been responsible for his disappearance. There was even gossip that Teresa and a lover had conspired to get rid of Ambrose, even though there was no indication that Teresa even had a lover. But now that her husband had sold off all his holdings and made them a great deal of money, perhaps Teresa finally decided to get rid of him as revenge for his infidelity and to keep the entire fortune for herself. Well, Teresa was interrogated by the authorities several times, who eventually became satisfied that she had no involvement in her husband's disappearance. Teresa's theory was that one of the other women Ambrose was involved with might have been responsible. Here's Andrea Canfield to explain more.
While Ambrose carried on numerous affairs, his favorite mistress was a woman named Clara Smith. Even though Teresa had tolerated her husband's womanizing for years, she finally demanded he stop seeing Clara after intercepting some letters she had written to him. Ambrose destroyed the letters and promised Teresa he would end the affair, but this turned out not to be true. After he went missing, Teresa found more letters Clara had written to Ambrose in his possessions. The most recent one was dated 3 weeks before Ambrose's disappearance and read, "I am the most unhappy girl in the world. I want you. Can't you suggest something after the 1st of December? You will be free practically. Let's beat it away from our troubles." It sounded like Clara was hoping Ambrose would leave his wife for her after he completed the deal. But after the authorities investigated Clara, they concluded that she had no involvement in Ambrose's disappearance.
Anyway, Teresa put up a $50,000 reward for information, which was a huge chunk of money in 1920. Of course, that only ensured that a great number of uncorroborated tips came in. One witness claimed he saw Small being forced into a car on the evening of December 2nd. Another thought he'd seen four men burying something in a ravine near Small's home. There was another witness who remembered seeing a notice pinned to the wall of a convent which requested, quote-unquote, "prayers for the repose of the soul of Ambrose J. Small," which they found unusual because his disappearance had not been made public by that point. It seemed very unlikely that Small vanished voluntarily, because the $1 million which was deposited into his bank account was never touched, and while investigators explored the possibility of a ransom kidnapping, no ransom note was ever sent. But it turned out there was an individual connected to Small who had gone missing at the exact same time. John Doughty had worked as Small's private secretary for 19 years, and given that Small was not known for being generous with his money, he only paid Doughty $45 a week. After the sale was completed to TransCanada Theatres Limited, Doughty was retained as an employee for them and given a new job in Montreal. During his final conversation with E.W. Flock, Small told him that he planned to ensure that Doughty would get a substantial salary increase in his new position. But after traveling to Montreal to start his new job and getting a room at a boarding house, Doughty suddenly quit his job and disappeared without explanation a few weeks later. Well, it turned out that he also possessed the key to Small's safety deposit box at the Dominion Bank, and on the very same day Small disappeared, Doughty accessed the box and removed $100,000 in negotiable Canadian victory bonds. So obviously, this made Doughty the prime suspect. In November of 1920, Doughty was discovered to be working at a paper mill in Oregon under an assumed name. He was extradited back to Canada, but he did not have the missing bonds in his possession, and they were actually hidden inside the attic of his sister's home. Doughty confessed to stealing the bonds, but denied any involvement in Small's disappearance and provided an explanation for his actions. Obviously, given his boss's immense wealth, Dowdy did not appreciate being grossly underpaid by him during his time of employment. Now that Small had made himself over $1 million and was going to retire in luxury, Dowdy thought he was entitled to his fair share. Dowdy claimed that when he removed the bonds from the safety deposit box, he had no intention of stealing them, but was holding on to them as collateral until Small paid him a substantial bonus for his many years of loyal service. Dowdy felt that $100,000 would be a fair amount, and if Small agreed to his terms, he would have given the bonds back to him. Of course, at the time, Dowdy did not yet know that Small was arranging for him to get a salary increase at his new job. According to Dowdy, he had dinner at his sister Jean's house on the evening of December 2nd, before she drove him to the train station to catch a train to Montreal. However, he first asked Jean to drop him off at the Grand Opera House, where he intended to confront Small and present him with the bonds. But since Small was not there, Dowdy gave a paper parcel containing the bonds to his sister, asking her not to open it because it belonged to his boss. He told Jean to rent a safety deposit box and put the bonds in there if she didn't hear from him within a few days. Jean agreed, and subsequently drove her brother to the station to catch a train to Montreal at 9 p.m. Jean corroborated this story and claimed that when she attempted to rent a safety deposit box, it was too small for the parcel containing the bonds to fit inside, so she took them home instead. Dowdy returned to Toronto a few weeks later in order to visit his sister for Christmas, but was unable to make contact with Small, so the bonds were subsequently hidden inside Jean's attic. Shortly after returning to Montreal, Dowdy learned about Small's disappearance and claimed that the news caused him to panic. He figured that after the bonds were discovered to be missing, he would immediately be blamed for what happened, so he decided to flee the country. For the theft of the bonds, Dowdy would ultimately be convicted of larceny and sentenced to 5 years in prison. He was initially charged with conspiracy to commit kidnapping, but the charge was dropped due to lack of evidence. The problem is that Jean Dowdy was able to function as an alibi witness and account for her brother's whereabouts between when Small was last seen at 5:30 and when he boarded the train to Montreal at 9 o'clock, so it did not seem like he would have had ample opportunity to murder Small and dispose of his body. John Dowdy died in 1949 and never stopped maintaining his innocence. The investigation pretty much hit a standstill after Dowdy was captured, and believe it or not, the man who gave us Sherlock Holmes, the one and only Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, almost became involved in this case. While visiting New York in 1922, Doyle was contacted by Toronto reporters who asked him if he would be willing to investigate Ambrose Small's disappearance. When word of this got out, the newspaper started running headlines like "Sherlock Holmes to reveal Toronto mystery," but even though he initially showed some interest, Doyle ultimately decided not to pursue the case. 1 year later, Small was officially pronounced dead by the courts for the purposes of probate. Teresa Small was named executor of his estate in his will, and she stated that she planned to leave her entire fortune to the Catholic Church. This did not sit well with Ambrose's sisters, Florence and Gertrude, who also happened to be devout Protestants. They contested the will, but Teresa was ultimately awarded her husband's estate. After this, Teresa pretty much became a recluse, and after passing away in 1935, she stayed true to her word and left everything to the Catholic Church. But this was not the end of the story for her. Here's Abby Martin to explain more.
After Teresa's death, Florence and Gertrude decided to work in conjunction with Patrick Sullivan, the publisher of a local tabloid, in an attempt to discredit Teresa, and they filed a motion to prevent the distribution of her estate. Sullivan had a prior history with Teresa, as his tabloid had once run fake photographs of her having sex with priests, which got him sent to prison for libel. When Teresa passed away, Sullivan produced a typewritten confession, allegedly signed by her, in which she took full responsibility for her husband's death. According to Sullivan, he personally witnessed Teresa sign the confession before she instructed him to give it to Ambrose's sisters after her death. Sullivan also produced a signed affidavit from a man who claimed that Teresa had offered him $20,000 to murder Ambrose before cremating parts of his body in the Grand Opera House furnace while burying the rest of his remains at a dump in Rosedale.
These allegations compelled the Ontario Attorney General to open up a special investigation into the case, which essentially functioned as a posthumous trial for Teresa. The basement of her former home was even excavated, but nothing was found. In the end, it was determined that her so-called confession was nothing more than a forgery, and after a full inquiry, the Attorney General concluded that Teresa had no involvement with her husband's disappearance and was completely innocent. By the time 1960 rolled around, the police officially decided to close the case, believing that since so much time had passed, there was virtually no chance it would be solved. They even decided to discard the 3-foot-thick case file. However, as the years passed, the mystery only gained more notoriety, due largely to the urban legend that Ambrose Small's ghost was haunting the Grand Theatre in London. As mentioned earlier, Small considered the Grand Theatre to be his personal favorite, and much like the Grand Opera House, there were always unconfirmed rumors that Small's body had been incinerated inside the theater's furnace. For decades, there were reported sightings of a spectral figure dressed in Victorian clothing who sported a walrus mustache and numerous unexplained supernatural occurrences. While I can't vouch for the veracity of this story, one of these alleged occurrences supposedly took place when the theater was being renovated in 1977, as a bulldozer clearing debris reportedly came within inches of knocking down the building's retaining wall until it mysteriously stalled without explanation. Anyway, in 2001, there was a new development when a memo was uncovered which had supposedly been written by Edward Hammond, one of the original Ontario Provincial Police Inspectors on the case. The memo was dated 1936, around the time when the Ontario Attorney General's inquiry into Teresa Small was taking place. Here's Casey Brandt to explain more.
Hammond wrote that he believed Teresa and John Doughty had conspired together to murder Ambrose Small and that there was a police cover-up to protect them. In particular, Hammond singled out one of the original detectives, Austin Mitchell. While Hammond was only interested in facts and logic, Mitchell was a lot more unorthodox with his methods and liked to consult psychics and spiritualists, so the two investigators frequently clashed with each other. However, this uncovered document has never been authenticated or released to the public, so no one knows if any of these allegations are true. After nearly a century, there are still no answers about the disappearance of Ambrose Small, and it remains one of Canada's most infamous unsolved mysteries. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold.
So as a Canadian, I can tell you that this story is pretty much our country's equivalent of Jimmy Hoffa's disappearance, as it has pretty much transcended your standard missing persons case. Once people start spreading stories about having seen a missing person's ghost, then you know the story has become larger than life. It's also quite interesting how Ambrose Small's disappearance took place only 5 years after another infamous missing persons case, the disappearance of Ambrose Bierce, author of such works as The Devil's Dictionary and An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, who vanished without a trace during a trip to Mexico in 1914. This once prompted writer Charles Fort to remark, "Was somebody collecting Ambroses?" While I make it a point to try and not say unfavorable things about the victims in any of the cases I cover on this podcast, nearly a full century has passed, so I really don't have any qualms about stating that Ambrose Small was not a nice man. He sounded like an incredibly greedy, self-centered person who only married his wife so he could gain access to her fortune and constantly cheated on her at every opportunity. I mean, if Ambrose had been a better husband, his wife might have become concerned and reported him missing immediately. The case could have even been solved had she not held the attitude, "Well, he's probably just out gambling and screwing around somewhere." The guy mistreated his employees, had no empathy for poor people, loathed the entire concept of charity, and did not hesitate to step over anyone in order to attain what he wanted. And I'm sure I don't even have to tell you how troubling it is for a wealthy, powerful man to have a secret room behind his office to bring women who work under him. However, Ambrose Small's lack of morals is one of the reasons this mystery is so fascinating, because it sounds like there was no shortage of people who would have had motive to make him disappear. I guess you could say that karma eventually caught up to Small, as he was finally set to retire with a fortune and live the rest of his life in luxury, but never got the chance to enjoy his laurels. I think that one of the biggest challenges with analyzing a case this old is that there's a lot of misinformation out there. While researching it, I uncovered a ton of sources which provided conflicting details about many aspects of this case. This probably has a lot to do with the fact that the case was officially closed in 1960 and the original case file just thrown away, so I can see how details of the story may have been fudged up during its multiple retellings over the course of a century. Thankfully, there are a ton of original articles about this case available at newspapers.com, which helped clarify some of the murkier details, and while I can't guarantee that everything I've shared here is 100% accurate, I did the best I could. Of course, this analysis will not be focused on all the ghost sightings and supernatural aspects which have made this mystery so legendary, but instead I will try and figure out the most likely explanation for Ambrose Small's disappearance. Now for starters, even though it would have been much easier for a person to just disappear and start a new life back in 1919, I'd say the odds of there being a voluntary disappearance in this case are very small. If there's one aspect of Small's personality which was consistent, it's that he loved money, so I just can't reconcile a guy like him depositing $1 million into his bank account, making a deal to be paid $750,000 over the next several years, and then just going off and disappearing without touching any of that money. I mean, now that Small had accomplished everything he could, and retired with a major fortune at his disposal, I could see him deciding that he's had enough of his marriage and leaving his wife, but there's no way he's going to leave all that money. No, the most logical explanation is that someone harmed Small on the night he disappeared, and that he was the victim of foul play. The problem is that it almost seems like he literally just vanished into thin air, and there's no evidence of what might have happened to him. It's also uncertain whether Small might have even left the Grand Opera House alive that night. It has been confirmed that his lawyer E.W. Flock last saw him there at 5:30 p.m., but there's also the account of the newsstand operator, Ralph Savine, who claimed that Small exited the Opera House and interacted with him before he walked away. I know the authorities were inclined to think Savine completely made up this story in order to insert himself into the case and become famous, which is certainly a possibility, but it's also possible that Savine's story is true and his interaction with Small did happen, but he just got mixed up about which night it actually happened. Remember, Small's disappearance did not make the news until 1 month later, so enough time would have passed for Savine to potentially mix his dates up. I think the best way to verify Savine's story would have been to check if the New York Times was late arriving at his newsstand because the train was delayed by a snowstorm on that particular day. I'm not sure how thoroughly investigators looked into this, but if there was no record of a train from New York being delayed on December 2nd, then that probably means Savine's story wasn't true. It's too bad that details about the last confirmed sighting of Small are so murky, because being able to confirm if he actually left the Opera House could help shed more insight about what might have happened. Because if Small was attacked and murdered inside the Opera House, then this narrows the possibilities a bit. I guess this would depend on how many people knew Small had sold off all his holdings and earned himself $1 million. I just can't overlook the coincidental timing of him disappearing immediately after closing such a large business deal. For someone who stepped on a lot of people's toes and made himself a number of enemies over the years, I could see how the news that Small was going to retire in luxury might set somebody off and prompt them to murder him. The kidnapping for ransom angle would make sense, as someone might have wanted to take advantage of his newfound wealth in order to extort money from his wife. Of course, no ransom note was ever sent, but I guess it's not impossible that something could have gone wrong while Small was being abducted or held captive. If he wound up dead, the perpetrator might have decided to dispose of his body to cover their tracks. But then again, as demonstrated by the Lindbergh baby kidnapping over a decade later, even if the victim is killed, the kidnapper might still go through the motions of pretending they are still alive so they can collect the ransom money. However, there are a number of people who might not have even cared about Small's money and decided to kill him out of spite. There are so many possibilities. He had made a lot of money betting on fixed horse races, so maybe he pissed off the wrong people. While Small did sometimes lose money while gambling, it sounds like he always paid off his debts, so I don't think he had any outstanding debts at the time he disappeared. And besides, if he owed people money, He could easily pay it back now that he had $1 million in the bank, so it wouldn't make sense for anyone to kill him before he got paid. Small didn't treat his employees particularly well, so one of them may have decided to get revenge before he retired. And of course, the guy carried on affairs with numerous women. He used his secret room to lure the actresses and chorus girls from his shows into his bed, and I wouldn't be surprised if he made promises to help their careers, but then dumped them immediately afterwards. It sounds like Small's favorite mistress was Clara Smith, who he was carrying an on-again, off-again affair with for years until the very end, even after he promised his wife the affair was over. The content of Clara's love letter seems to suggest that she was obsessed with Small and wanted him to leave his wife. If Ambrose was planning to retire with a large fortune, but no longer wanted Clara in his life, I could see how that might set her off, but it looks like investigators were pretty satisfied that she had nothing to do with his disappearance. So really, the two prime suspects who have always received the most scrutiny are Teresa Small and John Doughty. And man, it's incredible just how closely Teresa was scrutinized, because even though a number of people, particularly her sisters-in-law, tried to smear her reputation and brand her as the murderer, both before and after her death, it seems like law enforcement were pretty convinced that she wasn't involved. Teresa essentially got exonerated by the Ontario Attorney General at what was pretty much a posthumous trial, but even now, nearly a century later, there is still debate about whether or not she was responsible for her husband's disappearance. I mean, I can definitely see why people would be suspicious of Teresa, who pretty much had every motive in the world. Her husband was a serial philanderer who likely only married her because of her family fortune, and even though Ambrose had promised her he would end his affair with Clara Smith, it was obvious he had been lying to her and that it was still going on. They had just completed a business deal which earned them an extra $1.7 million, so Teresa would have full access to all their money if Ambrose was gone. And of course, she did not even report her husband missing for weeks. But on the other hand, if Teresa wanted to kill Ambrose, I don't think she would have done so for the money. Remember, Teresa was already wealthy before she even married him, since she was the heiress to a family fortune, so it's not like all this money from the sale to TransCanada Theatres Limited was going to considerably improve their lifestyle. Teresa was known for being a very charitable person whom, unlike her husband, did not like to flaunt her wealth and drop considerable sums of money on stuff like gambling. And it doesn't sound like she went overboard spending Ambrose's money after she was awarded his estate and wound up leaving the entire fortune to the Catholic Church after she died. Quite frankly, it sounds like the main reason Teresa may have been so maligned was because she was Roman Catholic. During the early 20th century, Toronto was a heavily Protestant city, where Catholics were often shunned. Ambrose Small himself was a Protestant, who did not even particularly like Catholics himself, and I'm sure there was resentment over the fact that Teresa got to inherit his fortune. Quite frankly, even if Ambrose had been a squeaky clean individual who had been the best husband in the world to Teresa, there probably still would have been major resentment against her because of her religion, particularly from Ambrose's sisters. Everything I've heard about Teresa's personality does not make her sound like a murderer, so if Teresa had been inclined to kill her husband, I seriously doubt it would have been motivated by greed. Even though she had tolerated Ambrose cheating on her for years, perhaps the revelation that he had been lying to her about ending his affair with Clara Smith might have been the final breaking point which compelled her to kill him. Now, it sounds like even Teresa's biggest haters didn't think she actually committed the murder herself, but instead hired someone to do it. Even though she was essentially cleared of any wrongdoing on two separate occasions, Teresa's name has been pushed forward as a possible suspect again in recent years due to this supposedly uncovered memo from Edward Hammond, one of the original police inspectors. Hammond expressed his belief that Teresa orchestrated her husband's murder, was present when the murder took place, and that there was a police cover-up to protect her. Now, there really isn't much info out there about this alleged memo, and I'm not sure if it was ever authenticated, but even if the document is legitimate, I would still take Inspector Hammond's claims with a grain of salt. Even if Hammond personally believed that Teresa was involved in the murder, that doesn't necessarily mean he's correct. As far as I can tell, there has never been any evidence to support his allegations that Detective Austin Mitchell helped orchestrate a cover-up for Teresa, so that might be nothing more than sour grapes on Hammond's part, because the two of them didn't get along. Quite frankly, Mitchell seemed like a pretty flaky police officer to begin with, so even if he botched the original investigation, that may have simply been the result of incompetence, rather than a deliberate attempt at a cover-up. Regardless of whether you believe Hammond or not, I do think the theory of Teresa hiring John Doughty to murder her husband is worth exploring. On the surface, Doughty does seem like the most likely suspect, with or without Teresa's involvement. This was a guy who had spent nearly 20 years being a loyal employee for a very wealthy, unethical man who did not treat or pay him very well. Now Doughty was going to watch his boss retire with over $1 million in the bank and have nothing to show for his many years of service, so I can see how this might have caused him to snap. This would be like if Bob Cratchit finally reached his breaking point and decided to make Ebenezer Scrooge disappear. Yes, Small was arranging for Doughty to get a salary increase at his new job, but I don't think he was doing this out of generosity, as Doughty was now employed by TransCanada Theatres Limited, so the pay raise wasn't going to come out of Small's own pocket. If Doughty was in a brash mood, he could have easily done something to his former boss before Small had the chance to tell him about the pay increase. Of course, the biggest thing which makes Doughty look suspicious is the fact that he stole $100,000 in bonds from Small's safety deposit box and then fled the country to start a new life. But let's not forget that Doughty did not take the bonds with him, as they were hidden inside his sister's attic until he was arrested nearly 1 year later. Doughty was found working at a paper mill, so it's not like he was living the high life while on the run, and it doesn't seem like Small's disappearance benefited him financially. Doughty's story was that he never intended to steal the bonds, but hoped to use them to convince Small to pay him a bonus he felt he was owed. And given that Doughty was Small's personal secretary, and probably knew some unsavory secrets about him, it would not surprise me if some blackmail would have been involved. Doughty intended to make this proposition on the evening of December 2nd, but he was unable to find Small, and asked his sister to hold on to the bonds until he could negotiate with Small at a later date. But once Doughty found out Small had gone missing, he panicked and fled the country. As ludicrous as this story may sound, it's worth reiterating that Doughty did not take the bonds with him. Granted, he may have just been paranoid that the bonds would be traced back to him if he ever tried to use them, but the one detail which suggests that Doughty might have been telling the truth is the fact that he went to Montreal and started working his new job. He did not actually take off until Small's disappearance made headlines 1 month later. If Doughty was responsible, why would he hang around that long? Not only that, but he returned to Toronto to visit his sister at Christmas and left the bonds behind in her house, which seems to suggest that he still intended to present them to Small at some point to get the money he felt he was owed. Now apparently, Doughty went to visit Teresa Small at her home during his Christmas trip to Toronto, which could easily give off the impression that they had been colluding together about something. However, the innocent explanation is that Doughty was still trying to track Ambrose down in order to present him with the bonds and went to see Teresa to ask if she knew where he was. At this point, Ambrose has not officially been reported as a missing person. He's just a guy who probably decided to take off to go gambling and womanizing for a few weeks to celebrate his newfound wealth. The main problem with the theory that Teresa and Doughty were in cahoots together is that if she hired him to murder Ambrose, it really doesn't look like he got much in return. Given that Teresa was loaded even before she met her husband, and Doughty's biggest beef against Ambrose was that he grossly underpaid him, then I'm sure Doughty would have expected a substantial payoff from Teresa in exchange for murdering him. But like I mentioned earlier, Doughty was found working in a paper mill in Oregon, so there's really no indication that he benefited from this financially. And if Doughty was paid off to commit murder, why would he take the $100,000 in bonds from the safety deposit box? Given that he was the only other person who had the key, surely Doughty would know that he would instantly come under suspicion if both Small and the bonds happened to go missing at the same time. If the bonds were his payment for the job, why would he leave them behind? I have to concede that Doughty's story about taking the bonds because he intended to extort his former boss and then panicking because Small turned up missing almost sounds crazy enough to be true. However, even if Teresa and Doughty were not in cahoots together, that doesn't necessarily mean that Doughty couldn't have committed the murder on his own. In fact, it may not have been premeditated murder. Doughty could have confronted Small at the Grand Opera House and shown him the bonds, but then the whole thing escalated into a heated argument, which ended up with Doughty killing Small. But if something like that happened, it would have had to occur within a window of approximately 3.5 hours. Small was last seen at 5:30 p.m., and it was verified that Doughty hopped on a train to Montreal at 9 p.m. Theoretically, 3.5 hours is enough time for Doughty to have killed Small, disposed of his body, and made it to the station in time to catch his train. The problem is that Doughty's sister, Jean, claims he was at her house during this time period before she drove him to the opera house for a few minutes and then dropped him off at the train station. If Jean is telling the truth and can account for her brother's whereabouts, then he could not be responsible for what happened to Small. Now, given that Jean had kept the stolen bonds hidden inside her attic for nearly a year, it's certainly possible that she could have been involved and lied to cover for her brother, but to what end? Once again, this was $100,000 worth of bonds which never got used. Yes, given the notoriety surrounding Small's disappearance, Jean might have just become paranoid to actually use the bonds, but if that was the case, why even keep them around? Why not destroy the one piece of evidence which links you to the most famous missing person in Canada? Whatever you think of Jean, it appears that investigators found her credible enough as an alibi witness that they dropped the conspiracy to commit kidnapping charge against her brother. I just think that if Doughty had committed murder, his first course of action would have been to flee the country immediately with the bonds, rather than travel to Montreal, settle into his new job for a few weeks, return to Toronto to visit his sister, travel back to Montreal, and then flee the country without taking the bonds with him. Call me crazy, but my gut tells me that Doughty is not involved, and it was just a bizarre coincidence that he decided to rip off a man who happened to vanish at the exact same time. So what did happen to Ambrose Small? Well, the only thing I am completely certain about is that he did not disappear voluntarily and was the victim of foul play, but I really don't know who could have been responsible. There has been a lot of unverified gossip in this case, such as allegations that Small's body was burned in the furnace of either the Grand Opera House or the Grand Theatre in London, which is probably inevitable when you're dealing with an unsolved mystery with supernatural elements and alleged ghost sightings. While I won't discount the possibility that Small might have been killed inside the Grand Opera House, I doubt his remains were left behind there. And I don't think his remains were buried or hidden in the Grand Theatre either, because London is nearly 200 kilometers away from Toronto, and that's a needlessly long way to travel to dispose of a dead body. There are much more practical ways to get rid of a body than journeying to a public venue in another city. No, I think the most logical explanation is that Small was either killed in the Grand Opera House and his body taken away from the scene, or he was abducted and killed elsewhere. But who could have done that? Well, I have a feeling it wasn't Teresa Small or John Doughty, but I think it's very likely his disappearance was related to the $1 million deal the Smalls had just closed. If I had a theory, it's that Small was probably abducted from the Opera House by one or more people who heard about his recent fortune, but since $1 million had just been deposited into his bank account, they would still need him alive at this point in order to access his money. But things went horribly wrong, Small wound up dead, and whoever was responsible disposed of his body. Small strikes me as the type of guy who would stubbornly resist if anyone tried to extort money out of him, so this could have conceivably gotten him killed. Since Teresa would have been able to access the couple's money, this may have been intended as a ransom kidnapping, but the plan was abandoned after Ambrose's death. But this is all just speculation on my part. I do think this is the most logical theory for what happened, but we'll never know for sure. Given that nearly 100 years have passed, and the police officially consider his case to be closed, I guess there's no need to conclude this episode with the obligatory advisory to contact the authorities if you have any information, because chances are that anyone who would have information is no longer with us. But by chance, if you visit the Grand Theatre in London and cross paths with Ambrose Small's ghost, maybe take a moment to ask him what happened. Anyway, that just about brings the 100th episode of The Trail Went Cold to an end. I would once again like to express my sincere thanks to our 5 contest winners, Heather Jones, Laura Folks, Andrea Canfield, Abby Martin, and Casey Brandt, who did such an amazing job at narrating sections of our episode. Of course, our contest is going to resume as usual, and each month, I will continue to make my random drawing in which one lucky winner will get the chance to narrate the opening of a future Trail Went Cold episode. If you've already entered this contest before, you are already eligible for my next random draw, so you don't have to do anything. But if you want to enter the contest and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. And before we bring this episode to a close, here's our special announcement about our upcoming podcasting event, so mark your calendars. On July 22nd, I will finally be representing the Trail Went Cold in my native country at a get-together called a Canadian Crime Podcast event, which is taking place in Toronto at a bar called The Hideout on 423 College Street. I will be joined by Christy Lee of Canadian True Crime, Jordan Bonaparte of the Nighttime Podcast, and Jack Luna of Dark Topic. It will be a casual meetup followed by a panel discussion and a Q&A. It runs from 5 until 8 p.m., and tickets are $10. Tickets are not available just yet, but they will be within the next few weeks, so keep an eye out for announcements in social media and upcoming episodes. And if you're signed up with us on Patreon and interested in the event, there's a special surprise just for you, so be sure to check out our Patreon page for more details. And maybe Ambrose Small's ghost will join us at the event as well. Anyway, like I just mentioned, The Trail Went Cold has just been launched on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat exclusive bonus rewards. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank 20 more of our listeners who have signed up to support us on Patreon. I mentioned on last week's episode that we've had so many folks sign up these past 2 weeks that it would take a while to thank everyone at once, so I'm going to do so in increments of 20 patrons per episode. So if you haven't heard your name mentioned yet, rest assured that you will get a shout-out on another episode within the next few weeks. Anyway, this time around, I'd like to send out a big thanks to Sam L., Heather H., Laura F., Ann W., Emily P., Joe S., Brianna L., Lauren T., Megan C., Sonia G., Lindsay K., Joshua S., Double A., Carissa S., Arish M., Jake, Beverly E., Matt D., Karen S., and Michael K. Thank you all so much for your generosity. And before we conclude this show, I would like to play a promo for a new podcast. It's called Impact Statement, and it's actually a solo effort hosted by Charlie of the Insight podcast, which also happened to release their 100th episode this week, so big congratulations to them. Oh, and by the way, the release date for today's episode also happens to coincide with Charlie's birthday, so happy birthday, Charlie! Anyway, here's the promo.
In court cases that end in a conviction, victims and their families are often allowed to make an impact statement, a statement of record of what they had before the crime and what they were left with after. But for unsolved crimes, crimes that don't end in a conviction, or serious life-altering events that aren't crimes at all, there is nowhere for the victims or their families to speak. Impact Statement is a new podcast that talks to victims and their families about life before, during, and after a life-changing event. Impact Statement combines compelling narration with interview clips to give a clear retelling while allowing those who have been affected the most to speak. Impact Statement can be found in Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.
Once again, I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So I have to send us off by once again offering my sincere thanks to all of you for your support of the podcast, because without you, we never would have made it to 100 episodes. And we'll certainly try our best to stick around and produce 100 more. So thanks again, and join me next Wednesday for our 101st episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶